chapter 11, commencing on page 497 of the copy of Tragedy and Hope, which recently formed part of my library, is as follows: Changing Economic Patterns. The chapter comprises material under the following eight headings: an introduction, Great Britain, Germany, France, the United States, the economic factors, the results of economic depression, and finally, the pluralist economy and world blocs. By virtue of recording time constraint this evening, we will be reviewing material related only to Great Britain, Germany, France, and the United States of America. However, I do plan in the near future to revisit Chapter 11 in its entirety and to publish all of Chapter 11 sections as individual podcasts. More on that anon. Before we dive into the meat and potatoes of a goodly proportion of Chapter 11, I first like to express my gratitude to Melissa in Texas for her initiative in working towards keeping the highly educational, wise, erudite, and most of all, common sense words of her late husband, Alan Watt, alive. And indeed, for augmenting Alan's words with her own very valuable personal insights, understandings, and experience with respect to both historical issues and indeed to issues of the moment. Melissa, via her YouTube channel and her material on other platforms, regularly posts valuable educational content under the title Real History with Melissa. Viewers or listeners with respect to Melissa's material are typically treated to all or any of the following: prominent real history and commentary on issues of the moment, Redux material as presented by her late husband Alan Watt, and or a combination of the above, together with interviews and discussions with some amazing people who make positive contributions to our current reality. So, thank you, Melissa, for all of that. Secondly, I would like to express my gratitude to Andrea and Darren in South Africa for either in whole or in part producing and administering the Cutting Through the Matrix Telegram-based book channel. The aforementioned channel I have found to be a valuable resource, fed regularly with links to a spectrum of educational items, mostly allied to the subjects within the books under discussion in the channel, none the least of which would be some of the very many books, both referenced and recommended, by the late Alan Watt during his multitude of past live radio and other broadcasts. Thank you, Andrea and Darren, for the research, development and support work relative to the Book Club channel, and indeed, for your own valued personal insights related to matters under discussion within the channel forum. Finally, given that most, if not all, participants here have a love of books, real, tangible books, and longing for both a broader and deeper understanding of the ways of the world in all their strange and oft-times sinister aspects, then I would highly recommend that participants here also subscribe to the excellent, in my humble opinion, companion YouTube and Telegram channels hosted by Nick Hayes. Nick, in a genial and engaging way, reads entire books, books of significant historic interest, on his YouTube channel, Hayes Reviews. Nick also participates in extended discussion with respect to the material he's covered on his YouTube channel via his Telegram-based Hayes Reviews private chat group. For Melissa's work, check out the following. On YouTube, Alan Watt, CCTM. That's A for Alan, W for Watt, and capitals CTTM. On Twitter, at Alan Watt underscore CTTM. That's capital A for Alan, capital W for Watt, and all capitals CTTM. For the work of Nick Hayes, check out the following. On YouTube, at Hayes Reviews, all capital letters. And on Twitter, at Hayes Reviews, capital H for Hayes and capital R for Reviews. And now, at last, the big picture and a journey into the mind of Professor Carol Quigley via some of the material from his Tragedy and Hope, Chapter 11, Changing Economic Patterns. Chapter 11 extends from page 497 to 555, a total of 59 pages. So let's kick off this evening's part review on page 499, that is, Great Britain. Carol Quigley informs us that 19th century Britain was awash with capital, with private savings being the main source of industrial financing, and goes on to point out that corporatization was a slow burn, with industry preferring the benefits of limited liability. Now, I ask the question, why wouldn't they? He goes on to state that investment banks, etc., were not interested in domestic industrial securities except for railroads. Apparently, for close to 100 years, banks had a marked preference for government bonds, both foreign and domestic. Quigley goes on to point out that 17 private merchant banks were able to find money for established and wealthy enterprises on both a long and a short-term basis. Some of those merchant banks, whose names no doubt many listeners may be familiar with, are as follows: Baring Brothers, N.M. Rothschild, J.H. Schroeder, Morgan Grenfell, Hambros, and Lazard Brothers. The merchant bankers, Quigley notes, had a dominant position within the Bank of England. A key event for Britain and her economy was the Labour government of 1946, who nationalised the Bank of England. Notable within the history of the Bank of England was the appointment of Lord Cromer, a Baring, as governor of the bank, and his subsequent serving of a term extending from 1961 to 1966. His board of directors were known as the Court of the Bank. The court, needless to say, included establishment insiders as representatives from other banks, such as Lazard, Hambros, Morgan Grenfell, and indeed also a presence from the company English Electric. Quigley observes that financial capitalism flourished in Britain from 1920 to 1944 during the governorship of Montagu Norman. However, financial capitalism had begun almost 100 years after the advent of industrial capitalism. So who then was Montagu Norman? Well, Montagu Norman, 1871 to 1950, was an English banker whose nickname was Currency Dictator of Europe. One might imagine he was deeply tied to the English aristocracy. What then was industrial capitalism? It was the economic system that emerged during the Industrial Revolution and was characterized by the dominance of industrialists over the merchant class and over the shift towards factory production. Quigley observes that industrial capitalism kicked off with the promotion of Guinness Limited by Baring's Bank in 1886. So what then was promotionism in the context of the banking business? Promotionism could be characterized as the communication of an invitation to engage in investment activity made in the course of business. So what did the bedding in of financial capitalism in Britain look like? The bedding in, so to speak, took place in the 1890s and was exemplified between 1894 and 1896 by the activities of one E.T. Hooley, who promoted 26 corporations with various noble lords as directors of each. Who then was E.T. Hooley? Oh dear, Ernest Terah Hooley, 1859-1947, is on record as having been an English financial fraudster. Maybe he should have bought himself into the House of Lords under an obscure title like Lord Corruption. Hooley's corporation's promotion package of the time had a total capital value of £18.6 million, of which Hooley took a mere £5 million, or approximately 26%, for himself. Nice work if you can get it. Quigley notes that although financial capitalism grew rapidly in Britain, it never achieved the heights which it did in the United States or in Germany. It seems that foreign countries were the chief areas of exploitation for British financial capitalism, that is, up until the crash of 1931. What then characterized the crash of 1931? It was a European banking crisis which saw the collapse of several major banks in Austria and in Germany. The fallen were Creditanstalt on the 11th of May 1931, Landeser Bank, the Rhine province, on the 11th of July 1931, and Danat Bank on the 13th of July 1931. Quigley points out that financial capitalism in Britain made little use of holding companies exercising its influence instead by interlocking directives and direct financial controls. However, the new kid on the block, monopoly capitalism, raised its ugly head in Britain via the intervention of men like William H. Lever, 1851-1925, and Alfred M. Mond, 1868-1930. Lever created a great international monopoly in vegetable oils via his business, Unilever, while Mond created the British chemical monopoly known as Imperial Chemical Industries, ICI. Quigley indicates that a downside of financial capitalism in Britain was manifest in the growth of financial control over industry and increasing concentration in such control, and also by an increase in banking control over government. He goes on to state that the influence of the Bank of England over government in Britain was an unmitigated disaster. However, banking power in business was less than it was in government, because British business remained self-financing to a greater extent than in other countries, and the early industrialization in Britain had facilitated the largely self-financing of British industry. However, industrialization elsewhere had eroded Britain's advantage, forcing British business to seek outside financial aid. Quigley notes the financial capitalism grew in Britain in tandem with Britain's capital plant becoming obsolete. He also noted Bank of England control over businesses was achieved indirectly through the joint stock banks, which were heading steadily towards less and less in their number, but towards more and more of their residual number being in control of British business. The diminishing prevalence of joint stock banks in Britain is exemplified by these numbers. In 1886, 109 existed. 33 years later, in 1919, 35 existed. And 14 years later, in 1933, 33 existed. An awful lot of 33s there, eh? Next for Quigley was another form of monopoly, that is, the so-called trust. The growth of a money trust in Britain, that is, meaning financial wealth controlled by a powerful few, prompted an investigation by a Treasury Committee on Bank Amalgamations. The ensuing report of 1919 became known as the Crown Report. Subsequent to the Colwyn Report, a government bill was drawn up to prevent further amalgamations, but was withdrawn on an understanding by the bankers, yes, a gentleman's agreement, that they would seek permission from the Treasury for any future amalgamations. Bank of England interests were thus protected and shielded from any foul winds emanating from monopolization in joint stock banking. Quigley notes that the dismissal of joint stock banks were as follows: 9 in Ireland, 8 in Scotland, 16 in England and Wales. He notes also that the combined deposits for these banks in 1933 were £2,500 million, £1,773 million of which was in the Big Five: Midland, Lloyds, Barclays, Westminster and National Provincial. He suggests that competition was keen among the Big Five banks, but that all were nonetheless subject to the Bank of England via the instrument of the discount rate, interlocking directorships, and indeed through tradition, ambition and prestige. So what then was the discount rate? Well, the discount rate can be summarized as follows. The discount rate is the interest rate for short-term money market instruments like commercial paper and treasury bills. Commercial paper being unsecured short-term debt issued by a corporation, and treasury bills being money market instruments issued by governments as promissory notes with guaranteed repayment at later dates. Quigley notes that in Britain, financial capitalism served to create the conditions of monopoly capitalism by insisting on orthodox deflationary policies, which eventually alienated industrialists from financiers. He notes also that monopoly capitalism finally scored victory over financial capitalism in 1931. He further observes that back in 1918, the Board of Trade had announced that Britain had 500 restrictive trade associations on the go. And in the same year, the Federation of British Industry, the FBI no less, announced that its goals will be focused on the regulation of prices, the curtailment of competition, and the fostering of cooperation in technical matters, in politics, and in publicity. The Federation of British Industry, he notes, also set their sights on the elimination of excess productive capacity and restriction of entry of new firms and the enforcement of minimum price regulations and production quotas. What a bully boy organization, eh? With respect specifically to production quotas, Quigley further points out that a focus in this direction was steadily strengthened during the 9 years, 1931 to 40. Circa 1937, we see the heavy gang becoming involved in the fray, with the House of Lords acting as a Supreme Court, handing out a decision permitting the use of duress against outsiders in order to force compliance with strict economic agreements. Amazing stuff. Quigley goes on to characterize the apparent death throes of British capitalism by stating as follows. Financial capitalism, which was seen as having held the British economy in semi-depression, achieved a last great victory when financiers led by Montagu Norman and J.P. Morgan forced the resignation of the Labour government in 1931. However, monopoly capitalism in Britain aspired to make the banking system its servant rather than its hitherto master. Without question, financial capitalists managing to get rid of the Labour government in 1931 was a key pivot point in British industrial economics, but might also be characterised as somewhat of an own goal. Well, why own goal? Well, the upshot of the financial capitalists' political stroke was that both Labour and industry were now united against the continuance of the bankers' economic policies of low prices and high unemployment. Quigley reveals that the absolute tipping point from financial capitalism into monopoly capitalism came in the wake of the revolt of the British fleet at Invergordon, the latter being a strategic base for the Royal Navy in Scotland, which took place on September 15, 1931. The mutiny had a clear message. The economic policy of deflation must be ended. Part of the unravelling following the mutiny was a decision taken, I assume, by Treasury not to make any effort to defend the gold standard. So with gold gone and protective tariffs in, there ensued a joining of forces between Labour and monopolist capital in efforts to raise both wages and profits. Quigley goes on to observe that under this new monopolistic arrangement, old monopolies increased in strength and new monopolies were actually formed. The forcing of restrictive practices both on members of the various organisations involved and upon outsiders became a norm. Incredibly, with respect to British business circles, productive capacity in their own lines were bought up and destroyed. In some cases, statute law was evoked, but in most, they were simply private ventures. And all the while, surprise, surprise, government made no real effort to protect consumers. Quigley quotes Herman Levy, 1881-1949, a British economist, as having observed, "Today, Britain is the only highly industrialized country in the world where no attempt has been made to restrict the domination of quasi-monopolistic associations in industry and trade." Quigley goes on to observe, yes, the British government did not accept the suggestion by Lord Melchett of the Federation of British Industry that cartels and trade associations should be made compulsory. But such free rein was given by the government that enforcing compulsion was simply not necessary. Why? Because refusing to adopt restrictive practices would simply ensure that your business would be ruined, the latter process being guaranteed via a combination of social pressure and economic duress. So what then was the outcome of all of this? Well, as a result of the prevailing regulatory regime, inefficiency, high prices and low output became the norm, in the face of which one dare not question or speak out, as to so do would incur a wrath of labelling as being socially unacceptable or even of being a traitor to Britain. Quigley notes that a significant dissenting voice of the era seems to have been The Economist, that is, the magazine which typically delivers content for high-profile individuals, organizations, and entrepreneurs, which, on the 8th of January 1944, stated, "Too few British businessmen are trying to compete. In these days, to say that a firm has so increased its efficiency that it can sell at low prices is not to give praise for initiative and enterprise, but to criticize it for breaking the rules of fair trading and for indulging in the ultimate sin of cutthroat competition." Quigley then goes on to provide two examples of the impact of restrictive practice regulation within the British economy as follows. Coal mines. Under the Coal Mines Act of 1930, production quotas were allocated to each colliery, and a requirement was laid down for fixed minimum prices. Shipbuilding. The National Shipbuilders Association, which had been established also in the 1930s, began buying up and destroying shipyards. This destruction was financed by funds from a £1 million bond issue, which was paid for via a 1% levy on construction contracts. Incredibly, the industry was being called upon to pay for its own destruction. So by 1934, one quarter of Britain's shipbuilding capacity had been eliminated, and the Millers Mutual Association, which had been set up in the 1920s, totally suppressed competition among its members and set up a purchase finance company to buy up and destroy flour mills. To me, all of this is truly incredible stuff, especially when one considers that 5 years later, Britain was going to find itself embroiled in yet another world war. So how damaging then was the cumulative impact of the economic policies followed by Britain during the mid to late 20th century? And on the negative impact of Britain's economic policies of the mid to late 20th century, though. For example, the Lancashire Cotton Corporation acquired 10 million spindles in just 1 year, 1936-37, and went on to scrap at least 5 million of them. Quigley goes on to point out that despite an international crisis, economic restrictive actions continued in Britain right up to 1940. However, Churchill's war-related mobilization brought fuller utilization of resources in Britain than elsewhere. Quigley notes that financial capitalism was well and truly defeated in Britain between the late 1930s and the middle 1940s. This by dint of full employment, which itself was a key and critical element within the Churchillian war economy. Quigley further observes that in post-World War II context, entrenched political ideologies and likewise entrenched economic ideologies hampered Britain's economic future. For example, the Labour Party in government 1945-51 under Clement Attlee represented the interests of the labour unions and more remotely the interests of consumers. While in contrast, the Conservative Party in government post-1951 under Churchill, Eden, Macmillan and Douglas Hume represented property classes and still continued to show strong banking influence. Quigley nonetheless points out that a kind of balance existed in which a welfare state was established, but at the cost of slow inflation and indeed the slack use of resources. It would appear that consumption and enjoyment rather than production were the hallmarks of the British economy, even under the Conservatives. Efforts were instead focused on supporting the value of the pound on foreign exchanges rather than productive investment. Well, at this juncture, I would briefly pause to toss the following question into our review mix. Would it be surprising that after 6 years of catastrophic war, the British people, on a rebound, would gravitate towards consumption and enjoyment, even for a limited period of time? Personally, I don't think that such a relatively immediate post-war economic reaction would in any way be surprising. And now, via the following observation, we see Quigley starting to identify the beginnings of the seismic change in in British economic reality. He records that the middle class, i.e. professional and educated groups, were not represented by either the Conservative Party or the Labour Party. Yes, there was a Liberal Party, but voters were very wary of the concept of coalition and of any prospective irresponsible government, which the inclusion of such within the political formula might produce. So what then did the new disruptive force look like? Well, it looked like managers, scientists, professional men, and imaginative parvenu entrepreneurs, the latter being persons of humble origin who had gained wealth, influence, and or celebrity. Such a cohort began to cause serious erosion within a very long-established British class structure. The emergent nouveau riche, as they may be identified, tended to ignore the older upper crust while at the same time being significantly resentful of even their very existence. So, Quigley concludes, partly my take this, this new rich lot, an amorphous, vigorous group, which apparently had no common outlook, by dint of its ever-increasing numbers, began to significantly blur the outline of the older classes. Moreover, Quigley points out that the adoption of a BBC accent made it even more difficult to identify class, education, and geographic origin of speakers. In addition to the aforementioned difficulties was the fact of the existence of improved appearance and health in ordinary English men. This by virtue of better living standards and, of course, the existence of the National Health Service. Interesting to note that clothing relative to men only remained the one characteristic which might be used to differentiate class. Women, on the other hand, Quigley asserts, were influenced by style magazines and cinema, tended towards wearing similar dresses, similar cosmetics, and presenting themselves with similar hairstyles. Looking back towards the economy, Quigley asserts that Britain's economy was made up of blocks of dynamic interest groups, all of which impact upon economic policies. Broadly speaking, there existed a tripartite construct comprising of 1, consumer living standards, 2, investment needs, and 3, government expenditure, the latter mostly being on defence. Under the model of monopolism, the British economy had seen banking pushed to the background in favour of governmental interests as handed down via the Treasury. He asserts that the weakening of the power of the banks in Britain had not occurred through laws, but instead had occurred through a shift in direction of investment funds, which increasingly bypassed the banks. By way of examples, he references larger industrial enterprises such as British Imperial Chemicals and Shell Oil, which he states largely financed with this having been achieved, which he states were largely self-financing, with this having been achieved on foot of monopolization through cartels, patent controls, or the control of scarce resources. In the brave new world of British monopolistic economics, Quigley reveals that finance generally came from government and from public authorities. For example, the National Coal Board, which produced £17 million per year in new money seeking investment. Furthermore, in 1961, the insurance companies provided £1.5 million per day in seeking investment. The largest of which, of course, was the Prudential, which poured out £2 million per week, much of which headed into industrial shares. And so, in 1953, the Conservative Party denationalised the steel industry, in effect reversing the Labour government move of 1948. Much of the associated shares were bought up by insurance companies. Quigley contends that the enormous funds involved created a danger that the handful of men who handles the investments of such funds could become a centralised power in British economic life. Prescience of 58 years ago, and not just for Britain. Today, but in global context, what do we have? Well, we have the cold, dark influence of 4 enormous funds impacting our day-to-day lives, namely BlackRock, Charles Schwab, State Street, and Fidelity Investments. Look them up. with a little condescension in my humble opinion, Quigley goes on to point out that another source of funds, this time from the lower class, could be found within the post office savings system. He claims that the lower class British look upon banks with suspicion. I say, how very perceptive of them. Seeing banks as alien upper class institutions, and as such, they, ordinary British Joes and Janes, preferred to place their savings elsewhere. Interesting to note that postal savings of over £6 million were about the same size as the deposits of all the seven joint stock banks, the latter being institutions owned and controlled by shareholders. Next up in Quigley's consideration were the pension funds, which reached a total of around £2,000 million by the end of 1960 and were increasing at about £150 million per year. His attention was next turned towards what he describes as the other two non-banking innovations, which he records as the building societies or buildings and loans in US context, and the hire purchase associations, that is, the installment buying organizations, or the Never Never, as the latter was once referred to here in Ireland. Never short on a wee bit of condescension, Quigley goes on to suggest that together, that is, the building societies and the installment buying organizations contributed to the wiping away of much of the dinginess of English lower class life. Looking back towards the banks, Quigley suggests that one consequence of the diminishing control of the banks was that the traditional method of controlling consumption and investment, that is, the use of charges and changes in bank rates, had become decreasingly effective. The beneficiary in all of this, Quigley implies, was government through increased control. But such came at the cost of a dampened down movement in business cycle. Government exercised controls through insisting on higher deposits on installment bank and higher carrying charges. He notes the wind change arrived for Britain's economy and states that Britain's formerly independent control of the economy began to come under increasingly uncontrollable influences outside, for example, from the United States and from the European Common Market, and indeed international agency pressures such as from the International Monetary Fund. Finalizes his review of Great Britain by concluding that what has developed was a complex, increasingly feudalized welfare, which managed rather than owners shared power with a complicated dynamic system within a complicated dynamic system whose chief features are still largely unknown, even to serious students. Moving to Germany, there was an immediate dependency by industry on banks. There were no specialized banks in Germany focused solely upon industry. Rather, German banks typically had multi-area interests, for example, commercial, promotion, investment, stockbroking, safety deposits. Quigley informs us that German banks typically floated securities for industry by granting of credit and by taking securities in return. Banks sold stock to the public as opportunities presented, but retained enough stock to ensure control for them. Banks also appointed their people as directors within related enterprises to give full effect to their control. For example, in 1908, the Dresdner Bank was holding 2 billion marks worth of securities, and by 1913 had its directors on the board of over 200 industrial concerns. In 1929, Deutsche Bank and Discounto Gesellschaft Bank amalgamated. Together, they had directorships in 660 firms and held board chairmanships in 192. Quigley elaborates further by advising that German credit banks acted as stockbrokers with securities left on deposit by investors. All such stock was then voted for directorships and other controls unless investors of stock expressly forbade such to occur. However, from 1929 onwards, financial capitalism began to wane in Germany. And so it progressed that German banks voted as a right all stock left as collateral for loans and all stock bought on margin. Clearly, stockbroking was a pretty important aspect of the German banking system, because between 1885 and 1908, one quarter of the gross profits of the large German credit banks came directly from commissions. Quigley reveals that a highly centralized financial capitalism was built up in Germany, and its period began with the founding of Darmstadt Bank in 1853, Darmstadt being the first bank to establish permanent systematic control over the corporations it floated. Darmstadt was also the first bank in 1859 to use promotion syndicates. Quigley goes on to indicate that promotion activity of the German banks reached its zenith together with associated levels of corruption in the period 1870 to 1874. Significantly, in this period, 875 stock companies and 3.3 plus billion marks in assets were floated. Comparatively, in the 19 years 1851 to 1870, just 295 companies with 2.4 plus billion marks in assets had been floated. Strikingly, Quigley goes on to note that of the 875 companies founded in the years 1870 to 74, 123 were in the process of liquidation and 37 were bankrupt as early as September 1874. And then there was action and reaction. In 1883, the German government enacted a law strictly regulating banking promotion. As such, bankers were now significantly circumscribed in their ability to make fortunes. This made it necessary for them to instead chase fortunes via a consolidation of control over industrial corporations and on a long-term basis. And so, it was short-term killings out for the German banks, and this being in stark contrast to the situation in the US, in which no such legal restrictions existed against any attempt at short-term killings via the banking promotions process. Quigley notes that equity capital had provided a sounder financial arrangement for German firms rather than the fixed interest bonds, a banking promotion favoured approach. Notable is the fact that financial capitalism was at its peak in Germany in the years just before 1914 and was at that time under the control of a centralized oligarchy. The Reichsbank, which was controlled to a significant degree by government, was central, though its control over the other German banks was weak, a situation particularly favored by the oligarchy. The Reichsbank, Quigley contends, was weak in influence over two important elements within the economic mix, namely the rediscount rate and the open market operations. A German law of 1899 had tried to strengthen the Reichsbank's hand by forcing other banks to adjust their discount rates into alignment with the Reichsbank. However, such turned out never to have been an effective control. Quigley observes that in the matter of open market, there existed a reluctance to speculate in government securities and a preference by the other banks to remain more responsive to the condition of their portfolios of commercial paper and securities rather than the size of their gold reserves. Quigley reveals that it was not until 1909 that the Reichsbank introduced a deliberate policy of control through open market operations, which in and of itself ultimately turned out to have been ineffective. And so World War I completely ended the Reichsbank's policy of control through open markets, during which period, mainly 1914 to 29, the additional impact of such issues as inflation and indeed the Dawes Plan provided the ultimate coup de grace. The Dawes Plan had emerged to facilitate a reduction in Germany's annual reparation payments and to allow for an increase in same over time in line with improvements within the German economy. Quigley concludes with the observation that because of the aforementioned weakness in the Reichsbank, the actual control of German financial capitalism rested within the credit banks, that is, beyond the control of the government, and as such, in private hands. The German great banks, so-called, held a lion's share of power within the German economy, and particularly so in the period 1865 to 1915. In 1907, there were 421 German credit banks with a combined total of 13.2 plus billion marks in capital, with the eight great banks holding 44% of the total capital. Quigley points out that the combined position of the great banks was even stronger because of their control reach within the numerous other German banks. Quigley goes on to further state that in 1907, Robert Franz, editor of the Deutsche Economist, estimated that the eight great banks actually controlled 74% of the capital assets of all 421 credit banks. Post-war inflation and depression, and indeed the actions of Hitler after 1933, served to totally spike financial capitalism in Germany. The once vice grip of financial capitalism was finally released when, in late 1923, inflation ended and cartels were given special legal status, with their own cartels court for dispute resolution. The cartels decree of November the 2nd, 1923. Quigley reveals that the former great control structure, which had been known as the Steins Combine, upon the death of Hugo Steins, a German industrialist, in April 1924, began to fall apart. At the time of his death, Hugo Steins had complete control over 109 large enterprises, that is, in heavy industry and shipping, together with significant interests in 4,500 other companies. Notable is the fact that much German savings had been wiped out by inflation, but despite this, there yet remained a significant need for capital in post-1924 Germany. And so Quigley observes that outside influence began to bear upon the German economy, with billions of marks and loans coming into Germany from foreign sources. In addition, Quigley notes that ultimately all the great banks, with but one exception, had as a result of the Depression period, 1929 to 1934, had to be rescued by the German government, and as such had achieved via the acquisition by government the capital stocks of the troubled banks. However, in 1937, all government-controlled banks were returned to private ownership, but by which time private industry had already escaped financial controls. Quigley points to the beginnings of the financial capitalism in Germany as arising during the generation before World War I, and that from 1870, financial capitalists had been trying to integrate enterprises for the purpose of reducing competition. In pursuit of such aims, and in the coal, iron and steel industries, the financial capitalists tended towards the use of cartels, while in the newer lines, for example, electrical, chemical, etc., they tended towards the use of great monopolistic firms. Quigley records the fact that there were 250 cartels in existence in 1896, 80 of which being in iron and steel. A Reichstag investigation of cartels in 1905 revealed the existence of 385 cartels, of which 92 were in coal and metals. It's interesting to note that not long after 1905, the government stepped in to assist the cartels by, for example, the Law of 1910, which forced potash manufacturers to become members of the potash cartel. Incredibly, Quigley notes that according to the Federation of German Industries, in 1923, there were 1,500 cartels, which of course now had special legal status and even had a special court created for them the following year. By 1931, there were no less than 2,500 cartels, with monopoly capitalism now surging towards a complete takeover of the German economic system. Quigley notes that private control of the economic system was now assured via a combination of the release of control from the banks and favourable legislation enacted by government, for example, the new corporation law of 1937. However, perhaps key was the fact that industry was now in a position to finance itself, thus obviating any need for bank involvement. Quigley notes that the new privately managed monopoly capitalism was organized hierarchically and in such a bemusing, intricate manner that it might be understood only following a lifetime of study. And so, for Germany, it seems that the size of enterprises had grown so big that in most fields, a relatively small number of such enterprises could and did dominate. Notable is the reality that cartels working between corporations fixed prices, fixed markets, and fixed output quotas for all important products. For example, 1937, there were 260 coal mining companies. When total mining output was examined, it was found that 21 companies accounted for 90% of the output, 5 for 50% of the output, and 1 for 14% of the output. 5 cartels were involved, of which 1 controlled 81% of the output, and 2 in combination controlled 94% of the output. Also interesting to note is the fact that most mines were owned subsidiaries of other corporations, which used coal, for example, metal producers or chemical producers. Quigley notes that similar concentrations also existed in other lines of economic activity. He goes on then to provide several examples of such concentrations and concludes that competition could never truly exist with such a concentration. He examples the strange hold of cartels by noting that the growth of cartels in the 40-year period 1890 to 1930 had led to a 100% control of the output of German ferrous metals production, and went on to state that cartels managed prices, production and markets, enforcing their will by means of fines and boycotts. Nice bunch of fellas, eh? The cartel rot had spread far and wide, because there also existed at that time an international steel cartel modelled on and dominated by Germany's. And incredibly, the international cartel controlled 2/3 of the world's steel production and 5/6 of the world's foreign trade in steel. Quigley goes on to note that Friedrich Flick, a German industrialist and later convicted Nazi war criminal, the latter fact of course not mentioned by Quigley, had a majority ownership in Gelsenkirchen-Bergwerk, which in turn had major control of United Steelworks. Apparently, Flick sold his control to the German government for 167% of its value after first threatening to sell it to a French firm. Good, loyal, patriotic German, eh? Post Hitler's arrival, the ownership by the government was reverted to a majority privatization, with a reduction in government holdings by 25%. Flick remained as director of United Steelworks, while at the same time being chairman of the boards of 4 other great steel combines. Quigley notes that it was very likely that the steel industry in Germany in 1937 was controlled by no more than 5 men, of whom Flick was likely to have been the most important. He goes on to provide an example of with respect to IG Farben industry, now a German chemical giant, founded in 1904 from the amalgamation of 3 firms. 2 years later, 22 years later, in 1926, IG Farben controlled 2/3 of Germany's output of chemicals and had spread into every branch of industry, having achieved 100% monopoly in dyes. Its reach included drugs, plastics, explosives, and light metals. Quigley notes that it had been said that Germany could not have fought either of the world wars without IG Farben. By World War II, circa 1942, IG Farben had the largest enterprise in Germany, with over 2,332.8 million Reichsmarks in assets and 1,165 million Reichsmarks in capitalization. IG Farben had 100 subsidiaries in Germany, employing 350,000 people. In addition, it had interests in over 700 corporations outside Germany and had over 500 restrictive agreements on the go with foreign concerns. IG Farben's significant agreement being one in the European dyestuff cartel, and later having grown, the latter having grown from a Swiss cartel formed back in 1918. Quigley notes that by 1929, industrial entities, for example, IG Farben, Kuhlmann, the Ciba Geigy, came together to form the European cartel. Imperial Chemicals, with a near monopoly in Britain, joined the European cartel in 1931. The aforementioned already having an agreement with DuPont in the US. Notable also is the fact that in the dyestuffs, IG Farben, via its subsidiaries in the US, was in a position to control 40% of American output. Quigley reveals that IG Farben's man in Havana, so to speak, with respect to control within the US, was one Dietrich Schmitz, who was a brother of Hermann Schmitz, chairman of the board of IG Farben, and indeed several more companies, including Heads Up, the Bank for International Settlements, or if you prefer, the Central Bank of Central Banks. How further in with the in crowd could one possibly get than with the latter? It would appear that Dietrich was sent to the US to become a naturalized American citizen and to become managing head and of the chief IG Farben subsidiary in America, namely American IG. Without question, IG Farben was the greatest example of concentrated control in German monopoly capitalism, but at the same time, not untypical. The process of concentration had been moving apace, and by 1939 had arrived at a level which could not be overemphasized. In the immediate aftermath of World War II, the Kilgore Committee in the US Senate, following detailed study of captured German records, determined that IG Farben and United Steelworks together could dominate the entire German industrial system. Quigley notes that such domination was facilitated by a complex mix of interrelated interactions, both personal and otherwise, which could not easily be demonstrated by recourse to statistics. However, in Germany in 1936, there were 40,000 limited liability companies with a nominal capitalization of 20,000 million Reichsmarks. IG Farben and United Steelworks together commanded 1,344 million Reichsmarks of said capital. Incredibly, just 18 companies out of 40,000 commanded 1/6 of the total working capital of all companies. Quigley contends that the difference between monopolistic capitalism in Germany and in other countries was simply a matter of degree. Although not realized, Britain, Japan, and other countries were not that far behind monopolistic capitalism development. Why? Because German cartels and monopolies were all well publicized, in contrast to the more or less hiding of same in other countries. Quigley observes as follows: what was notable among British consolidations is not their rarity or weakness, so much as their unobtrusiveness. For example, while there was so much known about Germany's IG Farben, in contrast, there was relatively little known, for example, about the British vegetable oil monopoly. German monopolism, however, courted disfavor simply because of its use in pursuit of nationalistic aims. Oddly, it seemed in German context that it was patriotism first, with power and profit-seeking pushed into second place. In contrast, elsewhere, for example, in the US, monopoly capitalists were first businessmen, with patriotism pushed into second place. Quigley states that IG Farben and other German industrial concerns were constantly working to help Germany in its quest for power. He also observes that the differences between German and other capitalists became increasingly more evident in the 1930s. Throughout the 1930s, patriotic and economic motives were in harmony within the German mind, and indeed focused in a common direction, which was to build a German nation in wealth and power as a bulwark against both Russia and the West. And what then of the capitalists in France, Britain, and the US? Well, it seems they were being exercised by the two threats of Bolshevism and Nazism. And according to Quigley, many were willing to neglect or even increase the Nazi threat so that it might be utilized against the Bolshevik threat. Quigley goes on to highlight what he believes to have been the difference between the German and other capitalists as follows. A. German nationalistic economics as distinct from the Western tradition of laissez-faire economics. B. World Depression caused the threat of social revolution to appear before Nazism arose as a political danger. C. Financial capitalism was replaced faster by nationalist monopoly capitalism in Germany than it was in the West, and D, many wealthy, like Montagu Norman, Ivor Kruger, Basil Zaharoff, and Henry Dietering, directed public attention towards the danger of Bolshevism while maintaining a neutral or favourable attitude towards Nazism. Quigley states that the impact of World War II on Germany was quite different than that on most other countries. For France, Britain and the US, the learning was the economic stagnation and unemployment of resources were not necessary and could be avoided if the financial system was subordinated to the economic system. However, for Germany, the Nazis had already made the discovery just referred to with respect to France, Britain and the US and made it back in the 1930s. Somewhat academic though, when your nation is now simply a pile of rubble, eh? Germany was left with the mighty task of having to rebuild its industrial plant. But such rebuilding could not commence until a new government was formed. As a result, the German people suffered immense hardship in the years 1945 through 50. German labour at this time, Quigley states, was eager for almost any job and were more concerned with just making a living rather than seeking to raise any standards of living. And so, a willingness to accept low wages became a key and essential feature of ultimate German economic revival. Also thrown into the mix was the influx into West Germany of millions of poverty-stricken refugees from the Soviet-occupied East, ensuring both a surplus of labour and low wages. These aspects, together with unorthodox financial operations in their own way, contributed to German revival. Quigley notes that the signal for business opportunity availability through German economic revival was given by currency reform in West Germany in 1950. In essence, currency reform offered entrepreneurs the possibility of large profits through the German state's tax policies. The arrival of the European common market provided Germany with a mass market, and so the combination of low wages, a docile labour force, new equipment, and a system of low taxes on producers, plus many years of absence of need for defence spending, all contributed to keeping Germany's production costs low on world markets, which in turn led to the development of a flourishing export trade. And, in the best tradition of why reinvent the wheel, the German example was copied both in Japan and in Italy, and in France also, but somewhat differently in the latter. Quigley notes that associated new economic activity in Europe resulted in a transformative burst of economic expansion and prosperity. In the common market area, which in turn heralded unprecedented mobility and affluence within European life, such being a kind never previously experienced. One example beneficiary from the economic expansion referred to by Quigley took place in the 1960s to southern Italy, which apparently heretofore had a number of very backward areas. Strangely, Quigley notes that one area in Europe which apparently did not benefit from the general economic expansion seems to have been Belgium, which Quigley states was hampered by obsolescent equipment and domestic social animosities. However, in France, the boom was delayed for several years on foot of acute political problems associated with the debt of the Fourth Republic, that is, heralded by the Algiers crisis of 1958. And moving to France. Quigley opens this section with the following statement. Financial capitalism lasted longer in France than it did in any other major country. As with Holland, the French roots of financial capitalism go back to a period preceding the Industrial Revolution, but grew rapidly in the 18th century and were well established upon the founding of the Bank of France in 1800. Quigley notes that at the time of the founding of the Bank of France, financial power rested within 10 to 15 banks, whose founders had come from Switzerland in the second half of the 18th century. Protestants all, said bankers were deeply involved in agitations leading to the French Revolution. Being shrewd financialists, when the violence of the revolution got out of hand, they, the bankers, backed Napoleon as a mechanism for the restoration of order. As a reward, Napoleon in 1800 gave the bankers a monopoly over French financial life. by handing control to them of the Bank of France. However, 1811 marked a situation in France in which most of the banks were now in opposition to Napoleon because they objected to Napoleon's focus on war. France, still within commercial capitalism, found constant war to be injurious to commercial activity. Quigley notes that allegiance was shifted within a cohort of banking from Napoleon to Bourbon, and as such managed to survive the change in regime. By 1815, a political agility seems to now have entered the equation. Such political agility ensured that the bankers who had controlled matters under the First Empire remained the main figures on a board of regents of the Bank of France until a reform arrived in 1936. The chief board figures were Mirabeau, Mallet, Neufritz, and Hottinger. Quigley notes that throughout the 19th century, a second group joined within the French banking circles. This new group, largely Jewish, was of non-French origin, but majorly Germanic. So, who were they? Well, some interesting names here. They were Rothschild, Heine, Fouild, I don't know how to pronounce that in French, Stern, and Worms. Look, I kid you not. The latter name Quigley clearly records as Worms. See page 516. A majority of these were Iberian origin, like Perrier and Mireille's. A turf war soon erupted between the older Protestant bankers and the new Jewish kids on the block. Manifestation of this, however, was largely political. Interesting to note, per Quigley, of course, is that some Jewish groups gave up their religion to move over to the Protestant banking groups, such as Perrier and Heine. Quigley states that banking rivalry continued through the following political periods. One, the July Monarchy, 1830 to 48. Two, the Second Empire, 1852 to 70. And three, the Third Republic, 1871 to 1940. While the Protestant group remained conservative in outlook, the Jewish group, on the other hand, supported the July Monarchy and the Third Republic, but rejected the Second Empire. Quigley identifies leadership within the contrasting banking groups and notes that the Protestant side leader was Mirabeau and the Jewish side leader was, surprise, surprise, Rothschild. Incredibly, Quigley discovered that despite the competition for banking dominance, previously described opposing groups, who together dominated French banking, nonetheless, in many instances, cooperated with each other. But wait, more complications filtered into the banking mix post-1838 with the slow emergence of some more new kids on the banking block, namely the Catholics, as represented by the following six: de Manche, Sellery, de Valier, de Germany, and Pillerville, Gourin, and Le Boursac. I'm murdering those French names. Apologies. The new six soon split into two directions. Some joined in alliance with the Rothschild, and the rest, largely Catholic, instead supported heavy industry and rose in tandem with industrial progress through the Second and Third Empire to become a most powerful industrial banking force, and was mainly identifiable as the Comité de Forge, the French Steel Trust. And so by the period 1871 to 1900, the three great economic influencers in France were A, an alliance of Jewish and Catholics dominated by Rothschild, an alliance of Catholic industrialists and Catholic bankers dominated by Schneider, and C, a group of Protestant bankers dominated by Mirabeau. Group A accepted the Third Republic while the other two did not. Group A was the wealthiest in the period 1871 to 1900 by virtue of its control over Banque de Paris et de Pays-Bas, or Paribas for short. As a result, by 1906, Paribas held a dominant position in both French economic and political life. However, in 1904, the Protestant bankers established Union Parisienne, an investment bank of their own. Between 1904 and 1919, the Union Parisienne group and the Comité de Forges group formed an alliance based upon a common opposition to the Third Republic, and indeed also in opposition to the Paribas bloc, or for ease of identification, the Union Comité bloc. The years 1844 to 1940 were dominated in France by rivalry between the aforementioned two great blocs, and as one might imagine, such rivalry paralyzed the French political system. The move in France from financial to monopoly capitalism was, in effect, delayed by the struggle between the two great banks, great blocs, and the paralysis in the political system as exemplified by the Dreyfus case, that is, a French army captain apparently falsely convicted of for passing military secrets to the Germans, and again in 1934 to 38 by depression-related political riots. Quigley contends that the financial and political turmoil in France contributed in no small measure to the defeat of France in 1940. Monopoly capitalism in France, Quigley observes, did not become evident until around 1925. And during the long transitional period into monopoly capitalism in France, private bankers continued to exist and indeed to grow in power. Governmental obligations, both at home and abroad, held the interests of the French bankers to the extent that both Rothschilds and Malleys developed intimate connections within government and, conversely, weak connections with the general economic life of France. In more ways than one, railroads made a difference within the greater French economy. Railroads required capital, way beyond the ability of any private banker to supply. Therefore, investment banks, savings banks, deposit banks, and insurance companies were all tapped as a combined source for railway investment funds. Quigley notes that the changing role of the private banker and states that they had become managers of other people's funds rather than lenders of their own, and also had become both influential and much less noticeable. Billions of francs were now under their control rather than simply millions. Such control was executed unobtrusively and not in the bankers' own names. And while acting in the background, they were concealed by many credit and financial institutions, the latter having been established to tap into private savings. The railroad heralded new economic powers as iron manufacture and coal mining were on the rise, and all free from banking control, as was the armaments industry. However, the latter was susceptible to government favour or disfavour. Quigley identifies the fields of textiles, iron making, and the areas in which, just before 1830, industrial capitalism, albeit slowly, began in France. Capital was not lacking, as apparently the French were careful savers, although with a preference for fixed interest obligations, typically in the form of government bonds, instead of equity capital, and had a marked preference for investing in family businesses rather than in securities of other origin. Quigley notes that corporatization, although permitted in France under French law since 1807, nonetheless grew slowly, the French preferring the concept of private proprietorships and partnerships, a preference which held strong even into the 20th century. Financing for the aforementioned typically took the form of profits and or family savings. Interesting to note, when the private proprietorships or partnerships grew in size, the French owners typically cut off the growth of the existing enterprises and instead started one or more new enterprises, which were then run alongside the existing older ones. Strong family feelings usually hampered the growth of large units of publicly owned corporations. Also, there was a reluctance to give outsiders any influence in family business. A restrainer in the growth of corporations was the French preference for fixed interest obligations over equity securities, a dislike by the French of the taxman. Ooh, now there's a thing. And indeed, a strong feeling against public authority also made it difficult to embark upon public rather than private forms of business. Despite the aforementioned, Quigley notes, industry did grow, with its greatest boost coming along with the railroads and its need for steel and coal, and indeed from the government of Napoleon III, 1852-70, which added an additional demand for armaments into the industrial mix. In Napoleon's consideration, there was one favoured firm of iron armaments manufacturers, that is, the firm of Schneider at Le Creusot. As a result, Eugene Schneider became a monopolist in the supply of arms and also sold materials into government-encouraged railway construction. Such involvement with Napoleon ultimately saw Schneider become president of the Chamber of Deputies and indeed Minister of Agriculture and Commerce. Quigley notes that post-1871, the heavy industrialists began to experience less political influence, resulting in a decision by them to form an alliance with the Catholic bankers. Two economic blocs now clashed in France, that is, the financial capitalists and the monopoly capitalists. Both had interest in industry and banking, but neither wished for the unorthodox banking procedures, which typically were the goals of monopoly capitalism. Ultimately, monopoly capitalism arrived late in France, and when it did, it arose between the two great blocs, with difficult implications for both, but outside the central control of either. Quigley notes that the name given to the emergent, autonomous and amorphous power group representative of monopoly capitalism was the Liel-Lyon axis, which rose slowly after 1924, but ultimately took over control of France by 1940. The door to financial capitalism in France was opened by the need for capital for railroad building and the establishment of Crédit Mobilier in 1852 may be taken as the date of such commencement. Interesting to note that Crédit Mobilier became the model which credit banks later established within Germany. Crédit Mobilier failed in 1867, but other credit banks were founded in its aftermath. Some were mixed business banks, while others were more specialized, and later being along the lines of many British and American banks. Quigley contends that excesses seem to be the order of the day for financial capitalism, which he claims was the case also in locations other than France. France, though, Quigley states, was a special case with respect to excess, as excesses certainly did exist there, especially post the reforms of 1884. However, French excesses were little when compared to the excesses in both frenzy and fraud, as displayed, for example, in the US. In France and Britain, financial capitalism exploits were to be found in both foreign fields and in government, rather than in business securities. Quigley states that delirium was the order of the day in financial capitalism in the early 1850s and again in the 1880s and yet again throughout much of the 20th century. Between July 1854 and 1855, no less than 457 new companies with a combined capital of 1 billion francs were founded in France. However, losses to security buyers became so great that on March the 9th, 1856, the government temporarily prohibited further issues of securities in Paris. Quigley notes that once again, in the period 1876 to 1822, over 1 billion francs of new stocks were issued, which led to a crash in 1882. However, financial capitalism has established a firm control in France throughout the entire period of 1900 to 1936. A French newspaper article in 1929 estimated that in a period of 30 years, from the Humbert embezzlement of 1899, more than 3 million francs, equivalent to the total public-private debt of France, had been taken from the French people by worthless securities. The beating heart of the French economic system of the 20th century rested within a group of near unknown institutions, that is, the private banks, 100 in all, but with only 20 of significance, with two, Rothschilds and Mirabaud, being more powerful than all of the rest. Quigley notes that said institutions were known as haute banque and acted as the high command within the French economic system. Just 40 families closely held their stock, with no reports ever being issued with respect to their financial activities. Quigley further notes that these private banks, with few exceptions, were the ones which set up the Bank of France. Their number breaks down as follows. 1. The 7 Jewish banks, namely Rothschild, Stern, Kane, Danvers, Proper, Lazard, Spitzer, and, yes, Worms. 2. The group of Protestant banks as follows. Mallet, Mirabord, Heim, New Flitz, Hottinger, Odier, and Verne. And 3. The group of Catholic banks as follows. Duvalier, Lubersac, Ledreau, Gauchot, and Dimash. By the 20th century, fissures and disagreements arose within the various banking circles, but nonetheless, they all cooperated in the management of the Bank of France. Quigley observes that the Bank of France had no autonomous power of its own, being controlled itself entirely by the private bank, banks plural, and an alignment by some of the latter in the 20th century with a small but amorphous group of industrialists. The Bank of France, therefore, was controlled by 40 families, and with only 200 stockholders being allowed to vote for the members, the Board of Regents, the governing board, kept matters pretty tight. Of the 200 who could vote for the 12 elected regions, 78 were corporations or foundations, and 122 were individuals. Both classes were dominated by the private banks, and had been so for so long, that the regents' seats had become practically hereditary. Quigley notes that the chief changes in names of regents resulted from the growth of heavy industry and the transfer of seats through female lines. Incredibly, 3 seats, ergo 25% of the seats, were held by the same family for well over 100 years. Notable is the fact that in the 20th century, the names of Rothschild, Mallet, Mirabeau, New Flitz, Duvalier, Burns, Hottinger, and their relatives were consistently on the Board of Regents. Quigley contends that the Bank of France filled the role of general staff for the 40 families which controlled the 19 chief private banks. The state was influenced by the Treasury's need for funds from the Bank of France, the influences on other banks being more exclusively French, for example, marriage alliances, indirect bribes, that is, sinecure positions in the banking industry and the like. And by a 100% dependence by French banks on the Bank of France during any crisis brought about by French banks having set aside dependence on gold reserves in favour of commercial paper. Quigley notes that at the time of crisis, the other banks invariably looked to the Bank of France, which had the capacity to involve itself in unlimited notes issuing to get them out of difficulty. Then there were the investment banks, the Bank de Fers, as they were known. They were dominated by Bank de Paris, the Pays-Bas, set up by the Rothschilds in 1872, and the Bank de Union Parisienne, founded by the rival bloc in 1904. These were suppliers of long-term capital to industry, taking stock and directorships in return. In 1931, Paribas had securities of 357 corporations, and its own directors and top managers held 180 directorships in the 120 of the more important corporations. Quigley notes that control was easily exercised via use of non-voting stock, multiple voting stock, cooperative directorships, and other refinements in financial capitalism. In the period before 1934, among the 16 directors of Union Parisienne were to be found Mirabeau, Hottinger, New Flitz, Verne, Wendel, Lubersac, and Schneider. The 2 large stockholders in the period 1935 to 37 were Lubersac and Mallet. In 1933, the directors of Union Parisienne held 124 other directorships in 90 important corporations. At the same time, Union Parisienne held stock in 338 corporations. Value of the stock held by Union Parisienne in 1932 was 482.1 million francs, and stock held by Paribas was 548.8 million francs, totaling to a combined stock holding value of 1,030.9 million francs. Quigley identifies the 4th line of control as comprising 5 chief commercial banks, which together in 1932 had 4,416 branches. At the beginning of the century, the five chief commercial banks had all been within Paribas Consortium. But following the arrival of Union Parisienne in 1904, they slowly moved towards the new bloc, with the Comptoir National de Comp being the first to make the move over. The control of the two great blocs over the credit banks varied throughout the 20th century. However, during this period, the older Jewish private group steadily lost ground. Bond losses on foot of World War I was the basis of decline in the Jewish group, a situation which had been bound up with international financial capitalism. Regional deposit banks came under the control of one or other of the two blocs. For example, Paribas controlled the stronger in the north, the west and the south, while the Union Comic Bloc was stronger in the northeast and in the southwest. Likewise, control of savings banks and insurance companies was also shared. For example, the largest insurance company in France, whose capital and reserves amounted to 2,463 million francs in 1931, had directors of Mallet, Rothschild, Neuflitz and Hottinger. Quigley notes that the cooperation between the two blocs relative to lower bank control did not extend into industrial or commercial activities. Banking competition in the industrial and commercial sectors was severe, with a life or death struggle being the order of the day between 1932 and 40. Geographically, in France, the banks were divided in influence between the East and the West, the Jewish group focusing on shipbuilding, transatlantic communication, transportation and public utilities in the West, while the Protestant Catholic group focused on iron, steel and armaments in the East. Quigley notes that outside of France, the Jewish group dominated in the colonies, North Africa and the Eastern Mediterranean, while the Protestant Catholic group focused on Central and Eastern Europe via the Union Européenne Industrielle et Financière, which had been created in 1920, as the economic counterpart of the Little Entente, the latter being an alliance formed in 1920-21 by Czechoslovakia, Romania and the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats and Slovenes for the purpose of common defence against any Hungarian revisionism. French banking international reach. Yes, the Jewish bankers were into petroleum products via the Banque de Paris de Pays-Bas, which in turn controlled Compagnie Française de Pétrole, which was allied to Standard Oil and to Rockefeller. The Catholic Protestant bankers, on the other hand, via Union Parisienne, controlled Petrofina, which was allied to Royal Dutch Shell and to Dietering. Quigley gets into some name dropping here. Jules Expriant, partner of Lubersac AC, in which François de Wendel was the majority owner, was also director of Union Parisienne and Petrofina, and Alexandre Bourguignon, partner of Luber et C, was also a director of Union Parisienne and of Petrofina. Charles Sargent, once Undersecretary of the Ministry of Finance and sub-governor of the Bank of France, was for years chairman of Union Parisienne and played a role in one bloc similar to that played by Horace Finley in the other bloc. Quigley goes on at this point to widen the field of names of individuals, many of whom moved through a revolving door, so to speak, between banking industry and government. It is evident, therefore, that the relationship between powerful individuals within the elevated administrative class in France and both industry, government and banking could usefully be visualized as a complicated wiring diagram. Outside of banking, the French economy was organized through a series of trade associations, industrial monopolies and cartels, typically controlled by the Protestant Catholic private banking bloc. While the Jewish banking group, however, mostly held to old-style financial capitalism, nonetheless, some individual companies controlled by the Jewish group joined the cartels and associations set up by the rival bloc. Infiltrations? Possibly. Quigley notes that central to the system of monopolistic industrial control within France was the entity known as Confédération Générale du Patron Français, CGDPF, which post the 1936 Matignon Agreement did the collective bargaining for most French industry. Financial controls, family alliances, and interlocking positions saw a complicated web of associations, cartels, etc., interlocking into the CGDPF. Within the system, the Comité de Forge trade association represented a widely scattered collection of small iron enterprises held pivotal position. Quigley highlights the fact that the Le Creusot factories and the Schneider family, having been so favoured by Napoleon III in 1838, ultimately emerged as the chief metal company in France. Circa 1870, virtually the entire metal industry of France began to turn towards monopoly capitalism, and as such, to seek capital from private banks. Quigley notes that the French favoured a concept which they identified as comptoir, that is, a joint selling agency. For example, in 1884, the Comité de Forge was formed as an association of metallurgical industries by use of a single comptoir so as to prevent price competition. 100 billion francs in securities was reflective of over 200 companies which together with their 8 billion francs of capitalization were within the Comité de Forge in 1939. By 1939, 75% of French steel production was from just six companies. It was similar within the French coal industry. Quigley finds the aforementioned unsurprising, as the coal industry was largely dominated by the same group as the steel industry. By 1938, 77% of French coal production came from 14 companies, three of which were owned by Wendel. Ergo, Wendel controlled 15.3% of French coal production directly, and indeed much more indirectly. Quigley notes the existence of Comte Central de Hullier, which, similar to Comte de Forge, in steel, played the same type of role for the coal industry. The latter was supported by taxes on collieries, which were based upon output. French coal was sourced in two areas as follows, the northwest around Lille and the southeast around Lyon, with the latter being controlled completely by the Union Comte Bloc. However, the northwest area was more heavily influenced by Paribas. Quigley notes that the significant influence of the Union Comité Bloc in such important areas as iron, steel and coal was balanced to an extent by the skillful use of communications by Paribas in their takeover efforts relative to strategic points in communication and in publicity. He records that there was only 1,506 corporations registered on the Paris Stock Exchange in 1936, of which apparently only 600 were important. If we added the 150 to 200 important corporations not Paris registered then, we would arrive at a total of 800 firms. Of the 800 firms, Paribas controlled 400 and Union Comte controlled 300. The whole Paribas system of the 20th century was controlled by guess who? Baron Edward de Rothschild. However, the active head was René Mayer, who was manager of the Rothschild Bank and a nephew by marriage of James Rothschild. Centre of operations for the Paribas system was Banque de Paris et de Pays-Bas, which in turn was managed until 1937 by Horace Finlay, a Hungarian Jewish family which had been brought to France by Rothschild in 1880. Banque de Paris ruled the significant part of the French economy controlled by this bloc. For example, many foreign and colonial enterprises, the likes of utilities, ocean shipping, airlines, shipbuilding, and critically, communications. Quigley now focuses upon Havas, a great French monopolistic news and advertising agency. Havas could and did either suppress or spread both news and advertising. Havas received secret subsidies from the French government for almost 100 years, a fact first revealed by Balzac, a French novelist and journalist. Subsidies which, by the late 1930s, had reached fantastic size. Haché, another significant French publisher, had a monopoly in the distribution of periodicals, and sizably so, in the distribution of books. Interestingly, this particular monopoly could be used to kill newspapers, which came to be regarded by the controlling powers as objectionable. L'Ami de People, owned and operated by François Coetzee, became the recipient in 1930 of exactly such treatment. Post-1934 and 1937, both major blocs, Union Comte and Paribas, suffered badly. the former as a result of world depression and the latter by a rise in anti-Semitism. Controversy about orthodox and unorthodox financial methods for dealing with the depression, and particularly by a growing foreign crisis. Rothschild desired an alliance with Russia and adopted a policy of resistance to Hitler while supporting loyalist Spain. Rothschild also favoured a continuation of orthodox financial policies and the building up of labour unions against the Comte de Forges. However, the Rothschild approach, Quigley asserts, collapsed from its own contradictions, a general lack of faith in it, and indeed pressure from Great Britain. In an almost dialectical nature, as the two older banking blocs weakened, the new kid arrived on the block, and it was known as the Liel-Lyon Axis. The LL Axis comprised of two regional groups, namely Northern Liel and Southeastern Lyon. Liel was a branch running in Brussels. Liel had a branch running in Brussels, while the latter had a branch running to Basel in Switzerland. Quigley notes that by virtue of monopolistic and interrelated economic activity in the following areas: electrical, utilities, chemical, artificial textiles and light metals, and the associated banks involved, the cooperative axis, which came to be identified as the Liel-Lyon axis, had emerged. Interrelationships within the Liel-Lyon axis existed for a variety of reasons, namely monopolism, narrowly controlled natural resources, large-scale operation utilizing byproducts and affiliated activities for profitable operation, and the use of closely held patents. The interrelationship, Quigley states, was rooted in the following reasons: the northern utilities were based on coal and the southeastern on water. Manufacture of light metals such as aluminium were concentrated where water power was available, manufacture was conducted by electrolysis, which in turn produced chemical byproducts. Therefore, the two light metal firms in France moved also into chemical manufacture. Quigley notes that the textile industry was already centered in the north and in the southwest. When this industry turned to manufacture of artificial fibers, it needed to ally itself with chemical firms, something which was achieved through the association, through the associated Gillet family. The textile families, etc., the Mott family, already controlled, in cooperation with Paribas, the richest of the coal mines. The coal mines began to generate electrical power at the mine sites, following which all byproducts were utilized for chemical and textile manufacture. The textile families of the north, for example, the Mott family, were already related to the textile families of the south, for example, the Gillet family, both by marriage and by trade associations. Therefore, it was easy for the Liel-Lyon axis to grow, and such occurred along family interrelationship lines. Quigley states that as a result of the stalemate between the two great blocs, France became completely paralyzed and as a result suffered defeat in 1940. Strangely, apparently defeat was acceptable to the Liel-Lyon axis because with German assistance, the LL axis began to take over the whole economy of France. Quigley now looks at foxes let loose in the henhouse. The Paribas bloc was destroyed by the anti-Semitic laws, and many of its chief strong points were taken over. The Union Camp bloc was crippled by, for example, the forced sale of Schneider's foreign holdings and most of Wendel's domestic holdings to the Germans. Main German beneficiary being Hermann Göring Berke, and the seizure of other Lorraine iron properties and the complete abolition of Comte de Forges itself. Meanwhile, the LL axis strengthened. The French chemical industry was forced into a single cooperation, i.e. Société Francolor, controlled by the LL axis and by IG Farben. The light metals industry was centralized within the Alas Forge A. Camarogue, and the textiles industry was centralized under France Rayon and ended up under joint Gillet German control. The automotive industry was controlled under the Camille, the organization and the automobile, and set up as a joint manufacturing with Société Générale Française de Construction d'Automobile. The entire system was controlled by a small group in Lyon, centered on the Gillet family, and represented politically by Pierre Laval. Quigley notes, with the three great economic blocs in France cooperating with respect to pricing policy, it became very difficult for Americans to understand what was going on, because no price competition could be observed within the market, as should typically have been the case. Cooperations also existed, by the way, in attitudes towards labour, although to a lesser extent. Where rivalries emerged were within the areas of economic and political power that manifested in the form of struggles for control of sources of raw materials, supply of credit and capital, and in the instruments of government. Quigley notes that in Europe, competing economic groups saw nothing wrong in cooperating in the use of the power of the state to enforce joint policies in areas of price and labour. Defeat for the French in 1940 finally shattered the stalemate between the great power blocs, which had paralysed France in the 1930s and done so much to make defeat possible. The two older blocs were disrupted under both the German occupation and the Vichy regime. Paribas, by the anti-Semitic laws, Union Comte, because its holdings were desirable to the Germans and to the French collaborators. The LLXs, led by Baroque de Indochine and Bank Worms, there we go, the worms again, sought to take over most of the French economy as willing collaborators with the Vichy politicians, Pierre Laval. While they were reasonably successful in doing so, the economic confusion of the occupation and the burden of the German occupation cost made it impossible to gain much benefit from their newfound position. Quigley observes that the three pre-war power blocs played no significant role in France post-1945. However, René Maire, active head of the Rothschild family interests, did become Minister for Finance in the early post-war government. In 1962, de Gaulle made the director of the Rothschild Bank, Georges Pompidou, Prime Minister. Implementation of new economic procedures in France post-World War II was hampered by political paralysis within the French parliamentary system, which was mainly due to a multiplicity of political parties. France was stalled in attempts to establish a satisfactory economic system by a military crisis in Indochina and by protracted, frustrating civil war in Algeria. The aforementioned difficulties did not begin to diffuse until 1958. Quigley credits France, however, with the achievement of having established the European Common Market, which Quigley goes on to describe as having been decisive. The European Common Market, Quigley notes, was established by the Treaty of Rome in 1957 with the following six members: France, West Germany, Belgium, Holland, Italy, and Luxembourg. The plan for the European Common Market was the removal of the internal custom barriers among members and the adoption of common external tariffs against outsiders, with the objective of the creation of a mass market to facilitate lower costs in mass production. Quigley notes the political instability in France was relieved by the establishment of a more authoritarian, remember that word, authoritarian, Fifth Republic, that is, via its constitution on the 4th of October 1958, following which France was then in a position to contribute more meaningfully to the development of the European Common Market. Fiscal austerity came to France in December 1958 with a devaluation of the franc, following almost immediately by a rise in economic activity, with growth in industrial production of 6.3% by 1961 and almost 8.5% by 1962. French gold reserves doubled within 2 years of the franc devaluation. Quigley notes that the OECD report of 1962, that is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, successor organization to the Marshall Plan, recorded that the French situation was an economic miracle. However, farmers and government employees seem to have obtained less than their fair share of said economic miracle, and indeed the ugly spectre of inflation in living costs began to emerge. Quigley notes that the new economic activity brought to France and the other European common market countries up to an unprecedented level of prosperity surged ahead of the drab conditions reflected in, as he describes them, the unfortunate countries behind the Iron Curtain. The British had formed the European Free Trade Association of the Outer Seven, that is, Austria, Denmark, Norway, Portugal, Sweden, and Switzerland, for the purpose of free trade among members, but no tariff against others. The British further sought to lift their economy with an attempt to join the European Common Market in 1962, but were stalled in their aspirations by de Gaulle, who required Britain to first renounce its so-called special relationship with the USA. And so, we arrive to the USA. Quigley opens this section by way of an introduction to a concept which he calls the pluralist economy. He states that although the USA journeyed through monopoly capitalism, it did so partially and in a distorted way, and only for a brief period of time. The USA, however, he notes, arrived into this pluralist economy in both an unselfconscious and a tentative way. Intriguing comment, eh? So let's see where he's going with this. What did the USA face? Quigley states it faced labor shortages, while at the same time enjoying unprecedented richness and resources. So labor-saving devices and high-output rates were sought after as an approach which reached into agriculture. As a result, a requirement for capital equipment was usually high throughout the U.S. history. This would always be a problem in any underdeveloped country in which savings were scarce. The absence of savings in the U.S. presented an opportunity from the earliest time for financial capitalists, and indeed ensured the financial capitalism remained active in the U.S. over a longer period and in a more extreme manner than it did in other countries. Capital which would ultimately see canals, railroads, and the iron industry develop had to be sourced from government subsidies or from foreign investors. Such was the observable situation throughout the period 1850 into the 1930s. Oh dear. By the 1830s, Quigley laments, was the fact that financial capitalism was well established in locations like New York and northern New Jersey, but so also were unprecedented levels of corruption, such as were never reached in any of the European countries. Well, colour me surprised, Quigley states that the associated corruption sought to cheat ordinary investors by flotations and manipulations of securities for the benefit of insiders. Crikey, how very Bernie Madoff, eh? Success in the corruption, it seems, was its own justification, and incredibly the practitioners were, together with their wealth piles, socially acceptable, without any consideration as to how such wealth had been obtained. Quigley names three early stars of the corruption circuit, all of whom were associated with railroad financial juggling, as Daniel Drew and Jay Gould, and also Morgan, who I assume was none other than J.P. Morgan. Of course, Morgan and his likes, Quigley contends, eventually became respectable, with a small R, that is, from longer sustained success which allowed them to build up established firms. The farming West seemed to have been on to the corruption and pushed for Wall Street reform. However, guess what? Yep, such reform was delayed and stalled by the close alliance which exists between Wall Street and the two major political parties, the latter being a relationship which blossomed between 1880 and 1900. Morgan dominated in influence within the Republican Party, but had competition from Rockefeller in Ohio. For Wall Street, by 1900, it was Democrats out and Republicans in. As prompted by the movement of the Whitney family from inner circle Democrats to inner circle Republicans, on foot of an alliance which the Whitneys established with Morgan. Repeat after me. In political party context, two cheeks of the same. I leave you to fill in the blanks. The next economic Teutonic plates move, Quigley reveals, was the Rockefeller family move from monopoly petroleum in New York banking circles via the Chase National Bank. Quigley notes that the weaving of a network incorporating both family and finance between the Morgans and the Whitneys and the Rockefellers, which was facilitated mainly through the Payne and Aldrich families. So the landscape of financial capitalism between 1880 and 1930 was formed by two great powers, both in New York, who in turn dominated a collection of lesser powers in New York and in provincial cities. Quigley admits that the landscape in the 1920s cannot easily be described in brief, because it infiltrated all aspects of American life, and in particular, American economic life. At the landscape's core were 12 investment banks, all of which were unincorporated private entities. So, who were some of these? Well, J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, Kuhn, Loeb and Company, Dillon, Reed and Company, Brown Brothers and Harriman, and more. In essence, we had webs of economic power, and more important of which were based in New York and spread throughout other locations, such as Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Chicago, and Boston. Morgan, for example, was tied in with the First National Bank of New York. The Guaranty Trust Company, the Bankers Trust, the New York Trust Company, and the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. In a nutshell, the Nexus dominated a network of business firms which included at least one-sixth of the total 100 largest non-financial corporations in American business. The J.P. Morgan influence was substantial. It spanned 30 different firms and controlled $30 billion in assets. The Rockefeller influence, that is, one of monopolistic capitalism, while investing only its own profits, nonetheless, functioned as a financial capitalist unit in cooperation with J.P. Morgan. Rockefeller allied with the Chase National Bank, commanded industrial power in many Standard Oil firms and in the Atlantic Refining Company. More significantly, it controlled over half the assets of the entire oil industry and, in addition, $2.3 billion of assets of the Chase Bank. The Kuhn Loeb Bank dominated within the railway industry. It also dominated the Bank of Manhattan and, indeed, the Western Union Telegraph Company, the latter two together accounting for $11 billion in assets. The Mellon Group in Pittsburgh had mixed interests, as exemplified by their domination within Gulf Oil, Copers, Alcoa, Westinghouse Electric, Union Trust Company, the Mellon National Bank, Jones and Laughlin Steel, American Rolling Mill, Crucible Steel, and other firms, with total combined assets all of amounting to $3.3 billion. Wow, nice monopoly if you can get it. Quigley declares that in the mid-1930s, the 200 largest non-financial corporations and the 50 largest banks in the USA combined owned 34% of the assets of all industrial corporations, 48% of all the assets of all commercial banks, and 75% of the assets of all public utilities, and 95% of all the assets of the railroads. Quigley goes on to reveal that Morgan, Rockefeller, Kuhn Loeb and Company, and Mellon, plus DuPont, and three allied local groups located in Boston, Cleveland, and Chicago, together dominated the following percentages. Of the 250 corporations considered, 1, industrial firms, 58%, railroads, 82%, utilities, 58%. So, we're not just talking about the staggering economic power of the group just referred to by Quigley, but also the infiltration of this group into highly influential involvements in politics. Quigley notes that the Morgan and Rockefeller frequently dominated within the Republican Party, while at the same time, Morgan occasionally had extensive and significant influence within the Democratic Party, three of Morgan's partners being Democrats. Wielding state-level power, we had Morgan in New York, Rockefeller in Ohio, Mellon in Pennsylvania, and DuPont in Delaware. Morgan, in the 1920s, was hugely influential in both politics and business life, and at an international level, operating in cooperation with his allies, especially in Britain, had tremendous impact as business and geopolitics moved forward into the making of history. Quigley notes that, in a manner of speaking, investment bankers like Morgan ended up shooting themselves in the foot and succeeded in achieving this via their deflationary financial policies. They laid the foundation for economic collapse, which ended their dominance by the general social disaster of such a collapse experienced by all in 1940. It would appear that the road to financial capitalism's disappearance in the USA was more protracted than in most other countries, and did so did not seamlessly morph into monopoly capitalism. Quigley contends that three events worthy of mention contributed to the blurring stages from financial to monopoly capitalism. They were as follows. continuing personal influence of many bankers even after their power had waned. The federal political system, as exemplified by a decentralized USA, a tradition of anti-monopoly rooted in the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. Because of the three events, the USA did not reach a clearly monopolistic economy and as such was unable to adopt fully unorthodox financial policies capable of providing full use of resources. Quigley notes that unemployment in the USA reached 13 million by 1933 and remained at that level, at the level of 10 million in 1940. The USA took steps towards balancing the interests of economically influential blocs by greatly strengthening labour and farm groups and by sharply curtailing the influence and privileges of finance and of heavy industry. So what did the deflationary policies favoured by the banks do for US industrialists? Well, mass labour in the US, who were employed in iron and steel, were not unionised. Ergo, the declining prices for products from heavy industry could only continue to be produced profitably if costs could be reduced by the large-scale elimination of labour in favour of the installation of more heavy equipment. Quigley notes that the bankers stepped in to supply the necessary finance for supply of the new heavy equipment and indicated, by way of example, the financing of the continuous assembly line technique, which became associated with production at strip mills. Wow. With unorganized labor, employers could rearrange, curtail, or terminate labor without notice on a daily basis, thus reducing labor costs to meet falls in prices, which had resulted from the deflationary policies of the bankers. What a dark, virtuous circle and a lose-lose situation for labor, eh? Knock-on effects. What knock-on effects, the industrialists may have asked. What about the reductions in wages and the layoffs impact upon purchasing power within the economy? What about the negative impact of the aforementioned upon other groups selling consumer goods? The aforementioned, Quigley notes, were simply ignored. So farmers, light industry, real estate, commercial groups and other segments of society were negatively impacted by the deflationary policies of the banks and by the employment policies of heavy industry and later being closely allied to the banks. Quigley notes that the aforementioned policies became truly unbearable during the Depression years 1923 through 33, the result of which prompted the interest blocs, which had been Republican, to jump party ship, thus leaving the good old party completely subservient to a combination of both high finance and heavy industry. So the shift of the combined economic bloc to the Democratic Party, say, circa 1932, resulted in Franklin D. Roosevelt gaining the White House, and indeed the subsequent and to many infamous New Deal. The FDR administration sought to rein in the power of the bankers and heavy industry, and surprise, surprise, to reward and help the group which had elected it. And so what form did the help take? Well, for farmers, it was via subsidies. For labour, it was via government spending jobs into existence, which in turn provided purchasing power. And for real estate, professional people and commercial groups, it was via increasing demand from the increasing purchasing power of the farmers and labour. Quigley notes that the New Deal was a pushback against finance and heavy industry in order to prevent them from repeating their depressive actions of the period 1920 to 33. Investors obtained a measure of protection, and as a result, the SEC, that is the Securities and Exchange Commission Act, which came into being on the 6th of June 1934, financial exploitations and even bankruptcies had been engaged in, one by William Rockefeller in Chicago, in Milwaukee, and in St. Paul, and two by Morgan in New York, in New Haven, and in Hartford. Railway legislation sought to reduce such financial exploitation. The Banking Act of 1933 separated investment banking from deposit banking. Quigley notes another piece of legislation of 1933, that is, the National Labour Relations Act, sought to protect labour rights relative to collective bargaining. Another new administration imperative, Quigley notes, which emerged from the labour groups allied to the new administration, was to prevent industry from adopting policies of mass layoffs and or sudden wage drops in reaction to decreasing product demand. Following the formation of the Committee for Industrial Organization under John L. Lewis of the United Mine Workers, there was a significant drive towards unionization for steel, automotive, electrical, and other labor elements. So what did all the aforementioned not do? Well, it did not represent victory for unorthodox financing, which was a key element in monopoly capitalism, nor did it lead to any managed pluralist economy. Quigley notes that Roosevelt's New Deal, at a fundamental level, was orthodox in its ideas relative to the nature of money. Roosevelt, Quigley states, although willing to unbalance the budget to restore purchasing power, was oblivious to the actual cause of the Depression, and as such clung to orthodoxy relative to the nature of money. So it would appear that the symptoms rather than the disease were being treated by spending in an unorthodox fashion with money borrowed from the banks in an orthodox manner, that is, the latter being debt-burdened. Quigley notes that the New Deal allowed the bankers to print money, which the administration then borrowed and spent. In fact, the New Deal's borrowing was to the advantage of the banks, but their spending was so limited as to produce no meaningful re-employment of either resources. Quigley notes that despite Roosevelt having the statutory power to print greenbacks, that is, interest-free money, thus circumnavigating the banks, throughout his 12 years of power, he never did so. The entire New Deal episode exposed a failure to grasp the nature of money and the function of a monetary system, a gap in understanding which extended into the post-war era. Quigley asserts that Roosevelt administration simply did not grasp the nature of the economic crisis itself. Roosevelt and his Treasury Secretary believed that there was nothing so fundamentally wrong with the economy that a little pump priming wouldn't fix, that is, a little government spending, on a temporary basis, of course. Roosevelt believed that his pump priming would create demand for consumer goods, which in turn would increase investor confidence and cause savings to be released into the economy as investments. He believed that the curtailment of powers in finance and heavy industry would prevent any reoccurrence of the collapse of 1929. Wow. Quigley refers to the steepest recession in history in the USA, which began in 1937, following a cessation of the previous 4 years of the New Deal pump priming. This marked a catastrophic failure, which was the theory of economic depression, which had been applied under the so-called New Deal. So where to now? Well, it was immediately back to credit-burdened borrowing from the banks for continued treatment of the symptoms, with little hope for any end to whatever spending programs would be required. Worse still, no one seemed to understand how to reform the system and transform it into alignment on a more prudential economic path. Moreover, full employment became a pipe dream because the administration could not find the courage required for the significant levels of additional borrowing necessary to make any meaningful difference in the unemployment numbers. Salvation for the administration came on foot of a rearmament requirement and indeed World War II. Post-World War II, however, there was the Cold War and then the space program, both of which allowed the borrow and spend cycle to continue. So today, US prosperity is not linked to any properly organized economic system, but instead to government spending. And of course, to stop government spending would trigger a return to acute depression. And finally, given our growing awareness of the network of technocracy, which, like a fast-growing briar, has been expanding all around us in recent years, we now very briefly examine some of Quigley's thoughts from the penultimate section in Chapter 11, the title of which being The Pluralist Economy and World Blocks. And I quote, "The management of the shifts of resources will be dominated by rationalist and scientific methods. encompassing analytical and quantitative techniques. Considerable freedom of discussion will be required in utilizations everywhere, as in communist states. Authoritarian and secretive methods will be used relative to resource allotments to the various sectors. There will be a very considerable modification of the areas and objectives of freedom in all societies in the world, with a gradual reduction of numerous personal freedoms of the past, accompanied by a gradual increase in intellectual freedom, which will provide technical innovations, that is, clash of ideas and the release of personal energies necessary for success or even for the survival of modern state systems. End of review. I thank you all for having been here this evening and for having given generously of both your time and attention. It was much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. It was very well done.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I'm going to stop the recording now.
Okay.
Unless anyone wants to comment, anyone can do.
I just wanted to say that was a really excellent presentation, very thorough and detailed, excellent delivery as well. And I really appreciate you doing that, Frank. It was fantastic. And it was good to be on the other side for a change, listening to you rather than, you commenting in my audience, listening to me. So that was a good pleasure. And I really think you've got a knack for presenting. You've got a wonderful voice and accent and delivery that is extremely pleasing to listen to. And well done. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Nick. I know what you go through now, being on the other end.
Frank.
Yes, Darren.
I just wanted to ask you why you were doing chapter 12. You're supposed to be doing chapter 11.
I thought it was nicer, Darren.
Cheers, Frank.
You're welcome.
Go ahead, Fiona.
Thanks, Frank. I just wanted to say that was you made such an effort and did a really good presentation of that. So thanks for the work that you've put in for that. It was appreciated.
You're very welcome, Fiona. I enjoyed it.
I'd just like to thank you, Frank. I don't like speaking much on the microphone, but thanks very much for your time. And also thanks to everybody in the group for participating and making this so enjoyable on a Saturday night.
You're more than welcome.
Thanks again, Frank. You really have put an amazing amount of work into this. And I think you've raised the bar for our next chapters.
You raise the bar so high that I'm like, I'm not going to volunteer for anymore. You got to do all the rest of them now, Frank.
No, folks, I'd like to be standing behind the bar with a pint glass in my hand right now.
You've earned it.
Yeah, definitely. You still got time before last orders.
Thanks very much, folks. Appreciate all the kind words.
I'm going to stop the recording now. If anyone else wants to add, speak now. But yes, thank you so much, Frank. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Andrea. God bless.